Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. Our guest today is Alan Shapiro, a poet who is going to talk about his most recent book, which is
Song and Dance,
published by
Houghton Mifflin.
And this book was published in 2002. It's available wherever fine poetry is sold and online. And the imprint is Mariner Books. And I had the privilege last night to hear Mr. Shapiro read from his poetry at the Suwannee Writers Conference here at the University of the South. It's really a mecca for creativity. And if you would tell me a little bit about this conference, the Suwannee Conference, and other conferences you've done for poets that might have an interest in something like this.
Well, the Suwannee Writers Conference is it's heaven for a writer. You know, I'm here with teaching with Mark Strand, a poet who I've been reading since I was in high school. And so to be sitting suddenly next to him, teaching a class with him, is like a dream come true. And the students are, almost all of them are either teachers, published poets, or MFA students who will soon be teachers and soon be published poets. So the level of accomplishment among the students is very high. And so for 2 weeks, it's like creative writing summer camp for adults, and you hang out with people who share your enthusiasm, and spend all your time either hearing people read or talking about literature, and getting paid for it.
It's kind of nirvana.
It is as close to heaven as the fallen world can come.
Yes. Now during the year. Tell us what you do during the year. I understand you're a professor, and tell us a little bit about your academic life, where you're at.
I teach at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. I teach in the creative writing program. I teach poetry at the intermediate, and senior honors level, and I also teach creative nonfiction. I've written two memoirs. One about the death of my sister from breast cancer in 1995, called Vigil, and then another book called The Last Happy Occasion, which is a series of personal essays about growing up in Boston in the 50s, 60s.
Beautiful. The Song and Dance, which we're going to talk about and read from today, I know holds a special place in your heart. And if you would tell us a bit about the genesis of Song and Dance, and how you were inspired, and who inspired you to write this collection.
Well, the book is a book-length elegy from my brother David, who was a song and dance man. He was a professional actor, musical comedy star. His last big credit was Sunset Boulevard, which he was in on Broadway with Glenn Close. So he'd been a professional actor since the age of five. And in 1998, 3 years after my sister died of cancer, he was diagnosed with brain cancer, an incurable form of brain cancer. And he moved from New York City down to North Carolina, where he was treated at Duke University Hospital and lived with me and my family at the time. From the time of the diagnosis to his death took 11 months. And the poems, in part, sort of follow the course of the illness. They also reminisce about his past. And they also meditate on the role of poetry in the face of catastrophic loss and illness, what poetry can do to help us deal with these devastating experiences, and also what it can't do. Hence the title, Song and Dance, in part is an homage to my brother, because he was a song and dance man, and indeed there are references to musical comedy that run through all of the poems. But the phrase song and dance also draws on that pejorative meaning of don't give me a song and dance, don't try to fool me, don't try to pull the wool over my eyes. And elegy, of course, traditionally in Western poetry has always been an attempt to come to terms with death and find something transcendently valuable. Often what's valuable is the presence of the poem that memorializes the loss of the loved one, and in a way replaces the loved one by providing an ongoing memorial to them. And insofar as it does sort of preserve some aspect of the identity of the loved one, is a kind of compensation for the loss. Well, what I'm doing is sort of writing against that tradition, saying, yes, I'm doing the same thing. I'm trying to elegize my brother and to affirm the value of his life and affirm the value of human relatedness in general and regard grief as the sort of wages you pay for that kind of love. But at the same time, I'm recognizing that the elegy, the monument, is an inadequate substitute for the flesh and blood that you have lost. Mm-hmm. It is, for me, the kind of elegy or the kind of poetry that I needed then when my brother was dying and that I need now would be a kind of poetry that would literally bring the dead back to life. Mm-hmm. And since it can't do that, it has to constantly acknowledge that it is not doing that. Whatever else it's doing, whatever kind of beauty it finds in the loss, in the life, in the suffering, it is still falling far short of what we need, which is for people not to die. Mm-hmm.
Did so you begin when did you begin the work on the book? Was it after the diagnosis or?
No, it was after he died. I was caring for him. I had two little kids at home and other sorts of things going on in my life. I was teaching. I had children to care for. And for various reasons, mm-hmm. my ex-wife was not really involved in either the care for the children or anything else. And so I had the children, I had teaching, mm-hmm. and I had my brother.
Yeah.
And so
I
was doing was just trying to get through every day. And my marriage disintegrated and dissolved the month before my brother died. Mm. I moved out of the house, though it was not my choice to do so, a month before he died. So I was in a new apartment, and I had, this is how I started writing. At the time, it was a very dark period. I assumed that I was always going to be part of my identity, part of who I was as a human being, as a man in this world. Part of that identity was always that I would be somebody's brother. And then all of a sudden, for the first time in my life, I was nobody's brother. I thought that I was always going to be my ex-wife's husband, and then I found myself nobody's husband. My parents, who are still alive, and at the time were not doing well, as you could imagine, having a second child die. Because their health was iffy, I was beginning to feel as though soon I would be nobody's son. So in the midst of all that loss, in the midst of all that discontinuity, I asked myself, well, what was I still? What am I still? And I was still a father, so I had my children that I took care of, and that was still very important to me, obviously. So. Mm-hmm. I was still a basketball player. I was playing a lot of basketball. I played a lot of basketball. And I was still a writer. So one way of consolidating my identity in the presence of all of this destruction and disintegration was to write my way through it. And it sounds odd, but the act of writing is always an affirmative, happy act, even if what you're writing about is how unhappy mm-hmm. and how unaffirming you feel. Mm-hmm. The act of writing is still an affirmation of value. Mm-hmm. And writing is always a way of being happy.
Thank you. Let's start with Everything the Traffic Will Allow. And what Mr. Shapiro is going to do is introduce the poems. We're going to have five of them read today. Give us an introduction to the poem, and then he'll read the poem aloud to us.
Well, this is the opening poem in the book, and the title refers to a famous song by Ethel Merman. There's no business like show business. There's no business I know. Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. The poem deals with is a memory poem. One of my happiest memories in my childhood is of my brother and I lip-syncing that song to my parents before we would go to bed every night. We'd put it on the record player, and then we would do a little dance and sing that song. And so the poem recollects that.
Okay.
And at the same time, it and you'll see where the theme of the sense of inadequacy of art is. It is a representation of an experience. It's not the experience. And so the children in the poem no longer exist. They're just shadows. Mm-hmm. And so there's a tremendous sense of unreality about the whole scene. And in fact, one of the themes that runs through the book is that when the people who constitute your past die off, and you are the only repository of those memories, your own past comes to seem like a fable, like something that happened to other people. It loses all of its all of its weight and substance. So that's sort of what the. So it's also sort of a meditation on memory and on art as a kind of poor substitute for the experience it's representing. So it's called Everything the Traffic Will Allow. The two boys don't suspect they don't exist. And Ethel Merman is the shade of a shade. What Plato says all poetry is. A record spinning beneath a needle. As the boys lip sync into imaginary mics, her glottal swagger, brassy, large, streetwise, and from their mouths so touchingly naive for being so. There's no people like show people. Their parents clap and whistle from the bed, propped up on pillows. Everything about it is appealing. They are shouting encore, bravo, when the boys, like chorus girls, arms on each other's shoulders, step kick their way across the room and out of it, then back, stealing that extra bow. Shades of a shade, what poetry is, because there's nowhere else for them to be except inside the room, in which it isn't when it is, in which there is no room, unless I think of it. The boys, their arms flung wide on one knee, mouthing the last words before the needle slides off into silence. The parents propped up on pillows, half laughing, half shouting, bravo, encore, all now just the shade of a shade, like no people I know.
Thank you. You're listening to the KC Coar Show, a celebration of words. Our guest today is Alan Shapiro. He's reading from his newest book, Song and Dance. And now, Mr. Shapiro is going to read a poem for us titled Scan.
This is a poem about being in a waiting room while my brother is having a brain scan, and about the odd sense of community that grows up among strangers in a situation like this. There is a woman in there is a television set over the door of the waiting room, and there's a basketball game on, and the sound is turned off. And there's a woman in the room with the speaker who starts telling the speaker about her own husband, whose brain was damaged when the tumor was removed from, and he now has no capacity to feel anything. And her voice suddenly sort of seeps into the voice of the speaker of the poem halfway through, which I think you'll be able to hear that in the way I read it. So it's called Scan. I wanted to watch the game. The small room strewn with magazines was too dark to read in, lightless but for the frenzied pulsing of the muted screen above the door, and for the door which a nurse would open now and again onto a blazing corridor that this one's wife or that one's son, when called, would leave for or drift back from, dazed either way, coming or going, by the light first, then the dark. I wanted to watch the game. I could tell the time was running out by how the white team, spreading the court, touched past the ball from corner to key to corner so quickly that the yellow team couldn't get close enough to foul, the ball sailing just beyond their reach as they lunged for it, scrambled and dove, frenetic, hopeless, in a dumb show of defeat. I wanted to watch it, but the lady next to me, soon as my brother's name was called, was telling me the story. What we all share, our bond, our lingua franca, the before, the after, signs now unmistakable, but at the time ignored until the stroke or seizure. I wanted to watch the game. I wanted to tell the lady, "Lady, I don't know how long my brother has to live. My sister's dead. My parents are dying. Can't you just let me watch the game in peace?" But the automatic iron gears of courtesy engaged, and I was just so many different engines of attention. A nameless friend, a confessor, an innocent who can't have any idea of what it's like to live with someone you've spent your life with and see him this way, unable to feel emotion, like a well-trained zombie, because that's what the tumor damaged, where the feelings come from in the brain. My goodness, you must think it's so selfish of me to complain like this. I should feel grateful, shouldn't I? I mean, I know he has no sense of what we're all going through for him. And so he can't really love us now, not me, not even the children. But at least he isn't scared of dying, since he can't feel fear. It's a blessing, really. She looked away and smiled, apologizing for going on like that. the way my sister did in her last days, each time the nurse would decompact her bowels by hand. I'm sorry, she'd mumble, barely conscious. Sorry, sorry, till the nurse was through. Her relief then, less relief from pain than from the need, even then, to think of others. Didn't we all say it was so like Beth to do that? She could just sleep and no longer fuel the still inexorable autonomous machinery of obligations that displace us even as they make us who we are. Now he was back, her husband. He smiled when she introduced me, and before they left for the next test, next waiting room, he placed his hand on my shoulder and said, "Good luck, Godspeed." Said it as if he meant it, as if he could feel it. The gesture performing itself without him, like a blinking eyelid with no eye behind it. Up on the screen, the crowd stormed the court in silence as time expired. My brother was probably by then inside a long white tube where he dozed while pictures were being taken of all the hidden places in his brain. He was sealed off and all open. He was free and confined, and I wanted him to stay there where he didn't have to apologize to anyone for the delay, the inconvenience, as he would to me, as always, when he returned. I wanted to sit here and keep watching the nodding, radiantly bald head of the color commentator as he smiled a stiff smile and held the mic up high toward the mouth of the stooping 6'10 player of the game, who, I could tell, was thanking the good Lord for his God-given this or that.
Thank you. You mentioned something in the introduction that I have found to be true as well, and that there is an intimacy and a sense of community that does develop around people that have been gone through a tragedy or are going through a crisis.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting phenomena that